was most often seen astride his fine black thoroughbred horse named Prince. He was often accompanied by his two large wolfhounds.
Coming with nothing, absolutely nothing, going to the dump to find different pieces that still are usable to cobble together a house.
I followed Martin Luther King's philosophy as well as Father Grappi's philosophy, and as well as my father's and his father's and his father's philosophy. Color has nothing to do with it. It's the content of the individual.
So at 14, he started playing piano or somewhere around there and had a bunch of these bands. The last band we know of that he had was the Badger Serenaders.
We learned that in 1854, Farwell, Wisconsin, was officially changed to Viroqua. But why?
He got it in his head that if the very crooked Kickapoo could be unwiggled, it would be a boon to industry and local businesses.
Cruising down, cruising down, cruising down the river on a Sunday afternoon with one you love, the sun above, waiting for...
Welcome to the March 2014 edition of the Kickapoo Review, WDRT's monthly radio news magazine. I'm Bill Motlong. On today's edition of the Kickapoo Review, we'll be taking a look at some very interesting regional history and at a few of the fascinating people that were part of the diverse human landscape that left a lasting legacy in the area. So join with us as we take a trip back through time in the hills and valleys of the Okooch Mountains region. The round barns of Vernon County are a delightful sight to behold in our area, and nearly 100 years after they were built, 22 of them are still standing, more than anywhere else in the United States. Virtually all of those round barns were erected by an enigmatic African-American builder and his crew, who lived in an unusual social context for the times, a unique mixed-race community in the Cheyenne Valley near Hillsboro. The Kickapoo Review's Charlie Noer tracked down that story.
My name is Wilbur Arms. I'm descended from Samuel Arms and Otis Arms and Cecil Arms. Samuel was about 9-10 years old when he ran away for the first time from the Georgia plantation. And when he was caught, he was returned to the plantation. And shortly after that, within a couple of years, Sherman's army came through. And Lieutenant took a liking to him and made him their drummer for a battle. And he spent the rest of his time with Sherman's army until Sherman's army came through Illinois. And they were going to fight in the Black Hawk War. And my great-grandfather had decided he had seen enough people dying. So he left Illinois and came to Wisconsin, where he broke horses for farmers in the area and for in the military. Till he aged a little more, he heard about the Cheyenne Valley and eventually purchased land in the Cheyenne Valley and started to raise his family.
According to the 2000 census, the racial makeup of Vernon County was 98.8% white and 0.06% black or African American. To say it's a white community is certainly an understatement. However, near Hillsboro, in a place called Cheyenne Valley, a settlement of freed slaves was once home to Wisconsin's largest rural integrated community. Freed slaves and Native Americans joined with other European immigrants in this valley, where they worked side by side, farming, cutting timber, and building homes and barns. Wisconsin's early defiance of the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act and later the end of the slavery system encouraged freed slaves to settle in Wisconsin. Many settlers became landowners, and a few owned large acreages. The descendants of these black settlers still meet biannually as part of a Cheyenne Valley Black Settlers reunion, and when they get together, there is always talk about the joys and the struggles of their ancestors.
I never considered black and white. I was born in Bugby Hollow, just off of what they called Rebels Valley at that time. My grandparents, they married in 1897, and they had 13 children. She was a quarter Cherokee.
My family involves several of the original settlers, the Revels side, the Roberts, the Shivers. When I grew up there, we didn't know any difference. Grandma was grandma, and LG was LG. He was our grandfather. And we never thought of him as black or white, which one was and the other one was. And I brought my children up the same way, to be tolerant of others, and people are who they are.
My great uncle, he used to take me to town, and he'd point out different little white boys and little white girls and say, "That's your cousin, that's your first cousin, that's your, come on over here, talk to him, talk to him." And they'd be bashful and everything, and I'd be bashful too, because I say, how can they be my cousin, you know?
During the 60s, when I would return home and go to school, I spent my summers in the Cheyenne Valley, so I would do the school year in Madison on the east side, and I was in an interracially mixed school, and there was tension there, and I had to figure out where I thought I belonged in that group, you know, and I never had to think about that before.
Sometimes they think you're not as good as they are, or shouldn't have the same things as they have. As I look, I didn't think it was good at the time, but as I look back at it, it made me realize that if you're going to have anything, you have to put the time in, the self-discipline, the work ethic. And a lot of times where I would have given up on something, I kept at it until I was as accomplished or as good at doing something as anybody else was.
We still own a small farm there in the area, and we have our doors open just like they always were. Anyone coming through the area, they stop and they join us for dinner. We don't turn anyone away, and it's never been a question of race or what they look like or how they dressed or how they talked. It's always been an exchange of stories and camaraderie. I followed Martin Luther King's philosophy as well as Father Grappi's philosophy, and as well as my father's and his father's and his father's philosophy. Color has nothing to do with it. It's the content of the individual.
One direct connection to the story of the black settlers is the Round Barn, and Vernon County has the largest collection of round barns in the nation. Many of these barns were built by L.G. Shivers, a second-generation descendant of early black settlers in Cheyenne Valley. Filmmakers David Makaset and Shaheen Izadi have created a film about these barns, and recently I spoke with Shaheen in Philadelphia and David in Madison about their film, The Round Barns of Vernon County. I began by asking them how they located the descendants and what they learned from the interviews.
There were two things. One was we tried to do research where we could and reach out to people through phone calls and emails. But also part of it was just a very sort of hands-on, just get out into the area and politely approached people who live in the area, and most of them were very friendly and wanted to talk to us, and we started interviewing people that way. And I think it was almost by chance that we happened to stumble upon the Cheyenne Valley reunion. I think it's a biannual reunion. David, do you want to speak a little bit to some of the things that we learned?
What we learned was just fascinating. The direct communication of people's experience and how they came to the reunion was interesting. Some people would have heard from a cousin or another extended member of the family that this community had formed over the years and had, you know, kind of found a home there. And I think one of the real interesting things that Mr. Arms related was hearing from L.G. Shivers directly about why he chose to build round barns. Like, we had no idea that we would hear like such direct evidence, but that was an amazing discovery, I think.
Tell us the reason behind that, would you?
He actually was working in the summer side by side as a young boy with L.G. Shivers, and he asked him, "Why would you build a round barn?" And he said, "Because you don't have any corners to clean."
You know, as you say those names, it brings back history to me, because Algie Shivers and Otis Arms grew up with my grandparents in that era. And I clearly remember visiting and even living sometime in Hillsboro, where there were these elderly men. I didn't see the women. Elderly men in the community, in a very white community, and of course these people of color, these black faces, just stood out so remarkably. And I remember my grandfather introducing me to Algie and to Otis Arms as a young boy, which was a unique experience in such a white community. And their names have a ring to them that makes them sound almost bigger than life. Otis Arms and Algie Shivers.
Yeah, their names carry a lot of weight. And when you hear their personal history with being veterans, with being entrepreneurs, being successful farmers, and really rooted in the area, they're that set of founding individuals for sure.
And it's interesting that some of the people that we interviewed on the roadside, while they might not ever have met Algie Shivers, he was almost this sort of mythic figure. People had different folk tales about them, or things that they heard, or interactions with his friends. And that was another really interesting thing that we learned, was these stories that people had about him.
You've been listening to my interview with filmmakers David Makaset and Shaheen Izadi. Their movie, The Round Barns of Vernon County, will be shown at the Madison Film Festival. You'll find more information at www.wifilmfest.org, and we will post links on the WDRT website. A special thanks to WUWM for providing some audio for the Black Settlers reunion piece. Part of this show was originally aired on the Milwaukee Public Radio program, Lake Effect. This is Charlie Knorr, reporting for WDRT.
When the sun comes back and the first quail calls, follow the drinking gourd, for the old man is waiting for to carry you to freedom. Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd.
There have been plenty of outsized historical figures that have been part of the Driftless region's past. One of those you've likely never heard of. Way back in the mid-1800s, a larger-than-life Southern gentleman emigrated to the area and made his mark in a big way in Vernon County and beyond. The Kickapoo Review's Ed Hallahan talked with local history buff John Syme about Colonel Reuben May.
John, would you please tell us about this Colonel Reuben May?
Well, Ed, Colonel Reuben May was a genuine political refugee in the nation of his birth. He was born and raised in the South, Pike County, Kentucky, where he came to own a 400-acre farm where he boiled and shipped salt. Then in 1861, at the age of 46, he enlisted in the Union Army in response to the secessionist drift of his home state. He served as a colonel of the Kentucky Volunteer Infantry. After his departure for military service, his neighbors and relatives descended upon his farm and burned his barns and stole his livestock. His wife and children were forced to flee for their lives to Springville, Vernon County, Wisconsin, where her family had settled in 1857. While her husband fought in the battles of Perryville, Laurel Hill, Murfreesboro, Vicksburg, Jackson, Mississippi, and many others, his wife purchased a farm west of Viroqua along today's Highway 56. On October 5th, 1864, Colonel May was mustered out of the service and returned to the bosom of his family in a new, strange land. And for the rest of his life, he slept with a pistol beneath his pillow in fear of reprisals from the South.
Well, now there's a lead, John. That's it, with a pistol beneath his pillow. That's amazing.
Yes.
So Colonel May is out of the service, and he's prominent in our town, I guess. What was his reputation here in Viroqua?
Well, ironically, despite his problems from the South, he was well known in 19th century Viroqua as the prime embodiment of the Southern gentleman. He dressed in a long black Prince Albert coat, riding breeches, high leather riding boots, and a large brimmed soft felt hat. He was tall and broad-shouldered. He actually resembled Charlie Daniels, the musician, even including the beard. He was most often seen astride his fine black thoroughbred horse named Prince. He was often accompanied by his two large wolfhounds, which he occasionally used to hunt wolves in the then still wild regions of Jefferson Township. He was known as being dignified, even aloof. He had a booming voice which could be heard four blocks away. It is not surprising that such a figure should find his way into politics. He started out as a Democrat, and then with the war, turned Republican. In 1870 and 1872, he represented Vernon County in the state assembly. He was an unsuccessful candidate for the state Senate in 1875, losing by a mere 6 votes. In the late 1870s, he became associated with the Greenback Party. He was the Greenback Party candidate for governor of Wisconsin in 1879, winning about 12,000 votes, or about 7% of the total. In 1890, he would run again as a third-party candidate for governor, this time as a candidate for the Union Labor Party, although winning only 2% of the vote this time.
So Colonel May and his family are still local, aren't they? They're buried in local cemeteries, is that correct?
They are. There's none of them that live around here now, but he has relatives in other states, such as Kentucky. Some of his relatives still live in Kentucky. Well, and in addition to his political career, he's important in the history of Vernon County in other ways. He himself claimed to be the first person to grow tobacco in Vernon County, which he did shortly after the Civil War. He just grew one crop and never did it again because there was no market in Viroqua or anywhere around to sell the tobacco. And so we had to wait for the Norwegians to come along and take that over. And he also was the benefactor of a school near his house, which later on became called the Colonel May School, out on Highway 56. And he died in 1902, and along with his wife and several children, he's buried in the Springville Cemetery. And one child, Alonzo May, is buried in the Viroqua Cemetery with a gravestone resembling a Masonic altar, including a Bible and square and compass carved in granite. And Alonzo was a benefactor whose generosity saved the Viroqua Masonic Lodge from bankruptcy in the Great Depression. And his framed photo hangs on the wall of that institution to this very day.
That is a marvelous tale. Yeah, that is a marvelous tale. Well, thank you, John.
Oh, you're welcome. Call any time.
Will do.
You are listening to the Kickapoo Review, WDRT's monthly news magazine. Today, we're talking about some of the fascinating history of the region and the interesting people that have made it that way. In the Vernon-Crawford-Richland County area, the makeup of the human landscape has had some rather intriguing changes over the past 40 to 50 years. Part of the reason for that was the so-called back-to-the-land movement of the 1960s and 70s. Scores of people were drawn to the area, with whole earth catalogs in hand, brimming with idealistic intentions, and ready to live simply off the land. The tale of those nouveau homesteaders has been the subject of a formal academic study by someone who grew up here during that time. The Kickapoo Review's Tamara Dean has the full story.
In the 1960s and 70s, inspired by changes in society and eager to try a different way of life, hundreds of young people moved from cities and suburbs to the Kickapoo and Pine River valleys. In part, they were drawn by the land, its fertility and beauty, and its low prices. 80 acres of mixed farmland and forest might have cost $5,000 in 1970. The newcomers sought a way of life that was simple and peaceful, more in tune with the land. Now those back to the landers, as some call them, are sharing their stories from that time.
I feel so fortunate to have heard and that they have felt comfortable enough to share all of that story with me.
Kelly Lemley, an oral history professor at Northern Arizona University, was raised in the Kickapoo Valley. Recently, she has returned to record the stories of her parents and others who homesteaded this area between 1965 and 1985. She and her research partner, Josh Fan, who was also raised in the area, conducted almost 100 interviews with individuals and couples. Now Josh and Kelly are compiling the stories. A book and perhaps a documentary are in the works. I spoke with Kelly during one of her recent trips to the area. Tell me, first of all, where did this project get started for you?
Well, I was doing my graduate studies at University of Wisconsin-Madison and working with the Menominee tribe up near Shawano, Wisconsin. And I just had an incredible experience gathering stories about indigenous language revitalization, what speaking and learning Menominee meant to elders, teachers, and students on the Menominee Reservation. And in my research classes, we talked about doing research in our own backyard. And I always thought, wow, if I could do something in my own backyard, what would I do? And that reminded me of stories that I've heard my parents tell over and over again of coming up here in the early 70s and making a life of it. I thought that would be the story that I would just be so interested to understand more about. It would be my history as well as understanding people's lives now and in the past. So that was pretty much how it came about.
I asked Kelly how she and Josh approached the interviews.
When we first started, we talked about interview questions. What do we want to know? How are we going to gather stories? And through my research classes, I learned this technique of, instead of asking a specific question, put "tell me" in front of the question, and that invites a story. So tell me about yourself, tell me about living up here, those kind of questions. And so we set out a set of questions, and since the very first time, we've edited them a bit, but we've really stayed with our four focal questions of, tell me what moving back to the land means to you. Because important in this research is to understand that not everyone calls themselves a back to the lander or a homesteader or part of an alternative group. They all call themselves different things, and that's really important to us as researchers and as community members to honor those identities. So that question, what does moving back to land mean to you, sometimes became, what does homesteading mean to you? Or what does becoming part of an alternative community mean to you? And then the next question is, how did you participate or not in homesteading, in alternative community, in back to the land? And then two more questions, which are the focal questions of, tell me what you came looking for and tell me what you found. So those are really the core questions. And then all around that are biographical questions, questions about what was appealing about this particular land. And we really are focusing on Crawford, Grant, and Richland County, because we realized as we started, there were a plethora of people that were able and interested to tell the story. And we really felt happily overwhelmed with the participant pool, but also realized that we needed to make it manageable.
While describing her research techniques, Kelly mentioned bringing a jar of local homemade jam to the interviews as a token of friendship. She also asked participants to bring something.
Part of the interview is bring an artifact that was important to you, or think about an artifact that you can describe that was important to you during that time when you moved or when you lived here. And so that artifact, as well as the stories that they tell through answering the questions, has become just a vibrant collage with different hues, different textures, different colors that really put together a picture of what living was like here. And I have a way of translating what that means, and I really think it's important to understand that the reader is going to have the ability to make sense of those stories too. And so when I think of narrative and I think of making sense of the stories that people tell, I want to be able to give pieces of raw narrative and perhaps analyze it, but also invite the reader to analyze it, him or herself, because that will be really important to me, that they will be able to participate in that same making sense of the stories that people are telling and sharing.
Can you give me an example of one or two artifacts or the type of thing that people would bring?
Mm-hmm. Oftentimes photographs, and it could be of their home, and it could have been in the local paper. Different ways of people moving into the area, making a home of salvaged materials, coming with nothing, absolutely nothing, and going to the dump to find different pieces that still are usable, and maybe looking at barns that have been blown down and asking neighbors and people in the area if they can use that to cobble together a house. Other artifacts have been music. Some people have played music for me that moves them, as well as talking about music as a profession. And so the piano or another instrument having a special meaning to them. Picking apples, so the apple and what that signifies to me versus them, that being a livelihood, a means of living here. And a milking stool. Buying a milking stool at the auction for 25 cents, and that being a means of livelihood too, to be able to go into the barn and milk.
I spoke with some of those who participated in Kelly's project about the artifacts they brought to their interviews. Maggie Jones, who moved to southern Crawford County in 1976, described a spear point she'd found on her property and how it made her reflect on the ancient past and those who lived on the land before her.
And then the other object I had was a map that I always like to say it changed my life. It was a map of the forests in the Driftless area and how large they are and how connected they are or are not. And that's sort of what prompted me to learn about the forest ecology in this area.
Russell Gilbert of Rolling Ground showed me what reminded him of his early days in the area.
These are two tanned mink hides. When I was a kid in Connecticut, for whatever reason, I found trapping to be attractive to me and another buddy, and I did it in Connecticut on a small scale. And when I moved out here to Wisconsin, that was never an intention, but I found myself in the middle of this treasure of everything from maple trees to fur-bearing mammals. And so one of the things that I've done over the years out here has made that a part of my winter experience.
I also asked participants how they felt about being part of an oral history project. Many shared Russell Gilbert's view.
Well, I guess you feel to some degree honored. At the same rate, it struck me as an interesting undertaking, because the truth of it is that the subjects, who are many of my friends, they're from diverse backgrounds and from all over the country, so the whole idea, how do we get here, and is there a common thread or whatever, is pretty cool.
In case you just tuned in to the Kickapoo Review, I'm talking with oral history professor and Kickapoo Valley native Kelly Lemley about the interviews she has conducted with people who moved to the area from 1965 to 1985. I asked Kelly about the answers she received. Tell me, in particular, the reasons many people gave for either going back to the land or becoming homesteaders or being part of an alternative community.
Overall, I would say living simply, living gently on the land, finding community, finding a place where you don't have to mow the lawn, and being able to really participate in, I would say, nature as well as life in a different way than they could probably in the place that they were coming from, which was oftentimes a suburban or an urban area.
Natural resources were just one of the aspects of the Kickapoo Valley that attracted Russell Gilbert, who moved here with his wife Pat from the East Coast.
It's got good water, good soil, a diverse plant and wildlife resource. It's just a spectacular place to live.
Barry Jensen arrived in the Gays Mills area in 1974.
I guess I didn't really have an agenda when I came here. As a matter of fact, I never even really planned on staying. I just came to visit and never left. People that I ran into, I felt more akin to here than I did any other place that I lived before this, you know. And I guess that's why I stayed here. I think of playing music now, you know, and I never played anything when I moved here. And just the fact that there's friends that would let you play along with them when you don't know how to play, I mean, you know, that in itself is just encouraging, you know. A lot of encouragement just for being who you are.
Kelly Lemley.
They became a family for each other. So each of those people played a part in community, and it may have been an intentional living community, or it could have been a neighborhood, and we know how large the neighborhoods are here. So it's not living side by side, but it's being able to share knowledge, skills, being able to share machinery, being able to share time, and being able to share a passion for understanding how can we make it up here together.
Did you get a sense for how the newcomers influenced the community that existed before they came here, you know, from 1965 to 1985?
I definitely feel a sense of the people that moved up here realizing that the local community had a knowledge base that was really important for them to learn from. And so whether it be how to drive a tractor, or whether it be how to work a certain machine, or when to plant, how to plant, that community that was the transient community really found knowledge with the local community. And the local community seems to have been interested in the knowledge that they brought too. Another part of this project is that I've been interviewing local people that were here during that time who had interaction with a lot of the participants that I've been interviewing. So it's been wonderful to hear how it is that they made sense of, why are these people moving up here? How is it that they can really up and move their entire family away from the family that they have? And that being something that was of interest to them, but also then also realizing that they became part of their family.
Feeling welcome in their new community was a common theme among the participants I spoke with. Other themes included the disappearance of small family farms and the influx of newcomers with dreams of a simpler life. Some participants described times when they struggled to stay on the land. Maybe they missed their previous hometowns and families, or simply couldn't make a living here. In fact, Kelly told me the majority of those she interviewed had left the area, most due to economic reasons. It seems quite possible to me that the participants telling their stories to you changed them or changed their regard for their experience. Do you have a sense for that?
Oh, I feel like it's changed them and changed me. I've cried with participants. I've laughed with participants. I've reminisced, as they say, I haven't done this for 30 years. I haven't thought about this for so long. And so it really is a moving and can be an emotional experience. And I really feel fortunate to experience that with them, to participate in that walking down memory lane and making sense of the choices they made, influences that motivated them to make choices that maybe they didn't think about at the time, but through the interview, they make sense of it in a different way.
This place has been good to me and to my family. And there are times I mentioned when I don't still feel that inner, almost aching love that I had for the magnificence of this place when we first came out here. But I will, and I'm 66 years old, stop from time to time in the garden or the yard or gathering hickory nuts and ask myself if this is where I hoped I would find myself 20 years ago or 40 years ago. And I can unequivocally say yes. So that's pretty sweet.
We accumulate this knowledge over our lifetimes, and then either it disappears or it's passed on. And if it disappears, it's just such a tragedy.
Kelly invites people who want to know more about her oral history project to email her at Lemley, L-E-M-L-E-Y, at yahoo.com. Or check the project's Facebook page, which is Back to the Land in the Kickapoo and Pine Valleys. For WDRT's Kickapoo Review, I'm Tamara Dean.
Just as is the case today, the Driftless region has always had its share of fine musicians. Back nearly 100 years ago, a musical prodigy from a prominent Viroqua family wound up in the entertainment industry on the West Coast and made a major mark on the pop musical world of the mid-20th century. In an interview on the WDRT radio program Life on the Radio, hosts Ed Hollihan and Jeannie Nordskog talked with Eddie Nix about the life and times of Freddie Slack.
It's kind of a weird story. So Freddie was born August 7th, 1910. His family lived in Viroqua. He was a child prodigy from all the stories we've heard. He started playing drums as a young boy. And this is in a house, Terhune and Center Street. Now, that house was Judge Terhune's house that he built way, way back in
himself.
The day. Himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Freddie's father bought the house sometime, around the turn of the century, let's say. So there was a lot of Slack kids in the family, and the Slack family goes back to one of the founders of the Viroqua area. His great-grandfather, Nathan, settled out in Liberty Pole, probably mid-1800s. So yeah, Freddie started to play drums, and then at about the age of 13 or 14, the Viroqua High School bought their first xylophone, and they had Freddie play it, and he was so amazing on this thing that they went to a state competition and he won all the awards for soloist. And then they went to a teacher's conference in Milwaukee with hundreds, if not 1,000 teachers. And he played a solo and they clapped so hard that he had to come back and do two or three more solos for these teachers. So at 14, he started playing piano. He was a kid who was definitely on a track. He had all kinds of bands around town here. He's always arranging little orchestras. But tragedy struck the Slack family. Freddie's father and his mother were at the Temple Theater, and they were watching a movie, and it was about February 22nd, I believe, 1927. They saw the show, and they were leaving, and right at the corner out here by Doll Pharmacy, where Blue Dog is, they were crossing the street, and a car with four teenagers in it crossed over into the sidewalk, hit Mrs. Slack, who fell onto Mr. Slack. His head hit the pavement, and for 4 days he was delirious, and they rushed him to La Crosse, to the hospital, and he died a few days later. Freddie was the last of eight children, and his mother and him moved to Chicago very quickly after that, and he was the last kid left in the family. They had all the other ones were grown up, and he immediately enrolled in the American Conservatory of Music, which was, at that point, one of the most prestigious music schools. And he studied with a guy named Tomford Harris, who was very well known and actually one of the most expensive teachers. Somehow they had some money, and my theory is that Charles, at the end of his life, had an insurance company in town. And he likely had a pretty good policy on himself, and that helped Freddie to moved to Chicago, where his career, in a sense, started. He moves to Chicago when he's 17, and he goes to the American Conservatory, but then he starts meeting all these jazz guys and seeing this boogie-woogie thing that's converging around 1927, 1928 in Chicago. All the black musicians from the South are moving to Chicago. So literally down the street are the three great boogie-woogie piano players of all time. This is Lux Mead Lewis, Elbert Ammons, and Pete Johnson. They're all living in this house right down the road from where Freddie lives. He starts playing with a band called the Johnny Tobin Band, which I can't find anything about, except that they played at the Beachview Gardens, which was a well-known mob hangout in Chicago. Around 1931, Freddie and Spike Jones, who is another one of my favorites, who had a band called the City Slickers.
He's a regular on Driftless Morning, Jones is.
A guy named Harry James, who was a very famous trumpeter, and another jazz guy, all took a road trip and left Chicago in 1931 and went to L.A. And then in the 30s, he played with Jimmy Dorsey. That was one of his big bands that he played with. And then left the Dorsey Band to create the Will Bradley Orchestra. This is where the boogie-woogie sound first happened with white folks. And that got a little old, I think, because he was always sort of third rate to Will Bradley, the great trumpet player, the boy with the horn, and Ray McKinley, who is this amazing drummer who went on to take over Glenn Miller's band after Glenn disappeared in a plane over the English Channel during the war. So at that point, he started his own band, and this is about 1941 in Los Angeles. Now, at this point, there's only like three legitimate record labels in the country, and they're all out on the East Coast and Chicago. There's like Decca and Victor RCA, and they each have a few sub-labels, but there's really only three players. So one of Freddie's best friends was Johnny Mercer, who is known as the founder of Capitol Records. Well, it turns out that more than likely, Freddie was one of the founders. So there was four of them instead of three. Mm-hmm. There was the guy who had the record store, the guy with the money. There was Johnny Mercer. And there was Freddie who had the music, okay? Mm-hmm. So he was sort of the house composer arranger for Capitol in those early days of the 40s. 42, they start the label, and the third session is cut with Freddie doing Cow Cow Boogie, which becomes their first gold hit and puts them on the map. So Freddie recorded with Capitol Records. He had his own band in various manifestations. There's probably like 10 or 12 different manifestations of Freddie's band. And the people who came through were just amazing. Like T-Bone Walker, for instance, was in his band in 42.
No kidding, really?
So he was way ahead of the game in terms of racial integration. Right. This is 1942, and he's got a black guitar player, very few integrated bands at all. And then later that year, he somehow gets T-Bone to record on Capitol, and his first hit, Mean Old World, gets released with Freddie playing. So it's just Freddie and T-Bone on those first two tracks that he recorded, and it's just beautiful. You know, T-Bone has this amazing guitar style, and Freddie's just completely complimenting him on the piano.
He was surrounded by all the top people.
Yeah.
He was discovering and going with. And
he arranged, you know, after his band broke up in mid-40s, for the last 20 years of his life, he was mainly arranging. So this is work that really doesn't get any appreciation. So that's what he did. And he played with small outfits throughout the 50s and early 60s. And then he had diabetes. And in the 60s, it got pretty bad. And he died in 65. And he, you know, unfortunately died kind of a penniless guy, like a lot of great artists.
That was my next question. I didn't want to hear that answer. I wanted to hear, well, you know, he socked a lot away and it was good.
Yeah, no. And in fact, there's a story that his fourth wife told me that Johnny Mercer, late in Freddie's career, came to see him when he was performing at some nightclub, took him backstage and just broke down and wept and said, "We screwed you over so bad, and I can't live with it anymore, and I gotta say I'm sorry, and they're doing it to me now." And that was what Johnny was saying at that point. There's also good friends of his like Don Ray, who was one of these vaudeville singers who wrote some of the witty lyrics, supposedly. His big hit was Down the Road a Piece, and he got that song from Freddie for $50 that he loaned him. Even though Freddie paid him the $50 back, he kept the song. And same thing with a guy named Les Baxter. Freddie was his mentor. It was over one day, and Freddie played him this beautiful song he had written. He said, great. And 2 weeks later, he had recorded it and stolen it, and their friendship was over. And I think Freddie was kind of one of those guys that had a lot of that happen to him. But it didn't matter, I think, to him, because as long as he could play, as long as he could compose and be around music, he was really classically trained. And the last song I think we're going to hear is his Bolero. And Ravel, of course, created the Bolero, and the Ravel estate held very close copyright on that word so that no one could do their own Bolero unless they got permission from the Ravel estate, which no one got except Freddie. Freddie wrote a Bolero and submitted it, and they said, yeah, this is, for some reason, good enough.
Ever wonder how a particular place got its name? Well, we did. We wanted to know where in the world the name Viroqua came from. So we sent the Kickapoo Review investigative team of Rena Meadow and Jacob Van Blarkum to find the origins of the city's unusual name. Here's what they found out.
Jacob Van Blarkum and I went searching for the story of how Viroqua got its name. We learned that in 1854, Farwell, Wisconsin, was officially changed to Viroqua. But why?
Some say that Viroqua was an Indian princess, the daughter of Chief Blackhawk. This tale claims that she got separated from the Indians as they were being chased by the military. Somehow she found her way to an area and discovered the cave that goes underneath the city. After several days, she left her hiding place to search for food. She was seen and chased by the white men. Deciding that there was only one way to escape, she rode her horse off the high rock overlooking the Park Bowl and thus ended her life. But that's not the only legend.
Other people tell the story differently. They say she died after losing her true love in a war raid on an enemy tribe. This version comes after someone long ago found an old clipping from the Milwaukee Sentinel. It cited a poem called "An Indian Maiden's Leap to Death" by Sanford Conant. The date on the clipping is obscured, and the Sentinel was unable to find the issue in its files to date the poem. One variation of this theme is that the true love lost was a young white Yankee settler. That story says Viroqua's Winnebago father rejected him when he asked for the daughter's hand in marriage.
There are problems with all these legend versions. There is no proof that Blackhawk had a daughter by this name, and researchers say the name Viroqua does not show up in any Indian languages in America. Other researchers found a reference to the name of a steamboat called the Viroqua. So, could someone traveling on the boat perhaps have suggested it?
Several historical references credit the daughter of William de Vries for suggesting the word Viroqua. She read the word Viragua in an 1851 Spanish romance novel. It told about the Indians on the Mosquito Coast that Christopher Columbus took to Spain. Word spelling sometimes changed long ago because handwritings were misread. Viroqua may have been a spelling of Viragua. A letter written by General Earl Rogers in an 1899 issue of the Broadcaster Censor tells that it was William Terhune, not the De Vries girl, who suggested the name from the novel. Will we ever know?
Maybe not, but perhaps we're lucky to be able to interpret our own variation from the many legends of Viroqua. I'm Jacob Van Blarkum.
I'm Rena Meadow.
Thanks for listening.
And finally today, we turn to something from the lighter side of the Driftless. For the past several years, Kickapoo Review writer and humorist Ed Hallahan has been conjuring up a character named John Johnson. Mr. Johnson's ersatz histories are of dubious veracity and considerable amplitude, and he says that he's 84 or 95 or 111 years old, depending on his mood at the moment. He claims to reside in the Admiral's Suite atop Shady Rest Home and Casino at the southern tip of Rainbow Ridge. Mr. Johnson, however, was kind enough to record one of his tales for the Kickapoo Review. His recollection of the time they tried to straighten the Kickapoo River.
It was spring of 1928. I remember because 1927 had been an especially good year here in the Drifter. Good for crops, good for livestock, and good for bank accounts, too. So everyone was looking forward to an even better year, albeit in a cautious sort of Scandinavian way. You wouldn't want to jinx a whole year, would you, by predicting that things would be great? So folks would usually finish their optimistic statements with a knock wood or a God willing tagged on just to be safe. When the mood in Viroqua was so upbeat, so can-do positive that the whole town was getting behind Mayor Ole Jensen's big idea, and it was a whopper. He wanted to straighten the Kickapoo River. The mayor had just returned from his visit to Chicago, where big projects are the norm. He got it in his head that if the very crooked Kickapoo could be unwiggled, it would be a boon to industry and local businesses. It would open a new shipping lane on which the bounty of the region would freely flow. The roads weren't of much use in those days, and goods pretty much went by rail or river, if they went at all. So the mayor reasoned, if we had a nice straight river for 100 miles or so, we could get a leg up at the dawn of the mass production age. The fact that almost nothing was being mass produced in Viroqua did not seem to bother the mayor. He was a visionary. All kinds of people had all kinds of notion about how to accomplish the gargantuan feat. I remember Pastor Hinkle proposed a unified day of prayer on which all the churches in the area would devote a few minutes of Sunday services to a simultaneous supplication of the Almighty. He was sure that we would all awake on Monday to a gloriously straightened Kickapoo. What the Reverend didn't realize was just how hard it is to get people of various denominations to do anything together, let alone change the course of nature. That poor man spent the better part of a year trying to gather his prayerful coalition. In the end, he got two churches, both Lutheran, one of them his own, the Viola Day School, and an Elks Lodge. That was it. Hardly the heavenly force Pastor Hinkle was counting on. A somewhat more physical approach was taken by the Dynamiters. That was a group of engineers, farmers, and Republicans who said that you could fix the river by setting off hundreds of strategically placed charges all along the course of the Kickapoo. They would be triggered sequentially, following a precise timetable so that at each bend in the river was blown off the map, the water would run directly to the next. Then that bend would be dynamited and so forth and so forth. By the end of all the explosions, it was estimated that the blasting would take 7 hours and 32 minutes. The result would be a narrow, straight waterway. The group was so confident that their plan would be adopted that they began acquiring explosives immediately following their first meeting. This stockpiling of TNT would soon backfire, so to speak. Wally Wallbender's barn, which was the storehouse for all this firepower, was separated from the planet one Saturday night when a carelessly discarded cigarette butt caused a flame in the hay, which set off the powder kegs which sent his cow and several chickens to their final rest all over Vernon County. Still and all, you had to give folks credit for their gumption. A lesser community than the Drifter would have folded their tent and retired to the rocker. Not us, no way. There was a woodsman down at the south end of the river in Waseca who was sure that if he hooked up enough horses to enough lines, he could pull that end of the river until it gave up its bends and just acquiesced to its new form. He happened to have a brother, also a man of vision, at the north end of the river in Ontario, whom he had talked into doing the same thing. So the both of them agreed that, on a given day, they would tug at their respective ends of the Kickapoo and straighten that baby out once and for all. Seemed like a simple proposition. You can do anything with enough horsepower. Of course, neither of them knew anything about water, what it weighs, what it likes, how it wants to flow. At 8 pounds per gallon, a river's worth of water weighs trillions of tons. I don't care how many Belgians and fjords you have in harness, you just can't pull a few trillion tons wherever you want. In fact, you don't pull it at all, even an inch, not at all. It was humiliating and expensive day for the boys. What started out as a proud statement about the power of men ended up a simple tribute to the force of nature. No contest. There were lots of other notions, most of them crazier than the last one, but it was the roaring 20s, ripe years for folks with lofty plans and big ambitions. Heck, my own brother got involved in an investment scheme where shareholders were sold a stretch of the newly straightened Kickapoo, over which they could charge river traffic a toll for passing through. Barges, $2, pole rafts, 4 bits, etc., etc. The fever was so high that many of these original investors actually sold their shares to new investors at a tidy profit. It was all too easy. Well, you know what happened in 29. The banks and businesses and all those schemes came crashing down together. And more than a few poor souls took their own lives to end the pain. But no one jumped from a window here in the Drifter. No, sir, not a one. Because it doesn't matter what the world throws at us. Folks here know in their hearts that better days are ahead. We just know it. Besides, there weren't any buildings tall enough in those days to provide a window of sufficient height to succeed at the aforementioned final leap. Norwegians are a proud people, and we would feel really foolish sitting on the ground with only a twisted ankle to show after their fateful jump. At least that's how I remember things back in the day.
Well, that's it for today's Kickapoo Review. Next month, the review team will be taking the month off in order to warm up. And in this time slot, WDRT will broadcast round 2 of the local storytelling event, Truth Be Told, held this past November at the ARC. Be sure to tune in at 1 p.m. on April 6th to hear more of the area's finest storytellers. We would also like to remind you that for those of you who like to time shift your listening, each downloadable recorded edition of the Kickapoo Review can be found on the very popular WDRT website, wdrt.org. Our thanks to the contributors to today's broadcast of the review, Tamara Dean, Ed Hallahan, Jeannie Nordskog, Rena Meadow, Jacob Van Blarkum, and Charlie Noer. Thanks, too, to David Klon and Dave Wendland for their production assistance. I'm Bill Motlong. Charlie Noer and I produced today's edition of The Review. From all of us at the Kickapoo Review, thanks for tuning in.
Above